From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hey, you punks, welcome to Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter, back again, holding the reins. And with me, once again, is Mr. John Grace. Say hello.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, I have to be here for this one.
Yep, you have to be. We were going to have Stu on this week, but he's had some last-minute stuff come up. But Stuart will be making his return next week. So we are starting a month-long series of shows. So look forward to that. But anyway, this is... We mentioned this movie. We haven't talked about it at length, but I think we even brought it up last week. We brought it up on the Milius show, but it's one of your favorite movies of all time, if I'm not mistaken.
It's my favorite, probably my favorite police action film of all time.
Of course, we're talking about one of the greatest cop movies ever, if not the greatest, probably the greatest. We'll see. We're talking about Dirty Harry.
Well, yeah.
You punks. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Directed by the great Don Siegel.
Yeah, the only one in the series directed by Don Siegel.
Yep, that's correct. I rewatched this movie with a friend the other day, you know, I was having a movie night at my house, but only one of my friends showed up, and we were just looking to see what to watch, and I just was like, oh, hey, Dirty Harry, you know, haven't seen this one in a while. And she said in her law classes, she said, oh, the Dirty Harry problem, something they learned about in law classes. And I said, what's the Dirty Harry problem? And I'm kind of oversimplifying. I might, you know, be leaving some stuff out, but she said it's like when a cop has to overstep the boundaries. If things turn out for the better, if things turn out positively, or if they go the way they're supposed to, then you're fine. But if you screw up, then it's your ass, basically, as a cop. It's kind of the Dirty Harry problem. But it was funny though when we watched the movie. I just said, well, let's watch Dirty Harry. She'd never seen it, and pretty quick into the movie, she goes, oh, I see what they were saying about Clint Eastwood, like why women were so into him.
It's funny because I grew up with a generation of women that didn't like Clint Eastwood because he was pretty old by the time I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was already like an old man and still taking his shirt off and stuff.
Yeah. What movies was he in at this time?
It'd be like Deadpool or Heartbreak Ridge.
Oh, okay, yeah. So like,
the guy is any sort of sex symbol or even Firefox. He's already old looking, you know. And yeah. I'll meet, you know, there's young women I work with today. They can't stand him because their idea of a movie star that's handsome is whoever is in the Twilight movies.
Right. These young guys. But like Clint Eastwood's career, he didn't
or
become
Vin Diesel, you know.
Yeah. I mean, but he was already and middle-aged by the time he became a movie star, you know.
Yeah.
Like he was in movies, like he was in like one of the swamp Creature from the Black Lagoon sequels,
Revenge of the Creature. He was in a Foreign Legion pilot movie called Lafayette Escadrille, mm-hmm. which I saw years ago as a kid on WTBS when they ran old movies all the time. They were kind of the TCM of their era. Mm-hmm. and I remember really liking it. Of course, it'd probably be corny as hell if I watch it today, but it was Clint Eastwood and Tom Laughlin. It was basically the Warner Brothers young contract actors were in all the supporting bits.
Wow.
And that included like John Saxon and probably a lot of other familiar names, but Eastwood was one of those Warner Brothers contract players who just played small parts and stuff, like you know, Lafayette Escadrille.
And Warner Brothers
could have been Universal. I should say it might be Universal. I forget which lot. You know, you just had these young actors that you would just hire. Okay, we need some young guys for this Lafayette Escadrille movie.
Because Warner's was the studio that he would go on to have a really close relationship with.
Yeah.
Because they put out Dirty Harry, and, you know, Clint would kind of, you know, get to do his movies. He'd, you know, and, like, you know, in exchange, he'd give him a Dirty Harry sequel or something. You know?
Right, right. He got to do the movie he wanted to do, like a White Hunter, Blackheart, or...
Honky Tonk Man.
Honky Tonk Man or play Misty for me, as long as he agreed to give them some sort, something they can make a franchise with, like a Dirty Harry movie or just a cheap action flick or any type of cop movie. And his stuff always came in under budget and on time, and because he's a bit of a cheapskate.
Well, it's funny. He directed,
but his stuff is competent.
He directed one of the scenes in Dirty Harry, the jumper scene, where he has to talk down the jumper. And Warner's had set a 6-day schedule for that scene, and Don Siegel had the flu and couldn't shoot it, and it would have been tough for him to shoot anyway because of the scaffolding and just, like, being up there. So, like, Clint directed the scene, and he shot it all in a night, like, finished it at 3 a.m., and it was, like, you know, this point of pride, like, you know, they wanted this bloated 6-day schedule to shoot this one scene. I got it done in a day, you know?
Right. That's the way he worked. And his stuff would always come in 2 weeks early or would wrap up, you know, 4 or 5 days early, $1 million under budget. You always heard the stories.
And do you think that, because he worked with Siegel a lot, you know, he did like Two Mules for Sister Sarah. And I think, did Siegel direct Coogan's Bluff?
A Don Siegel movie.
So like, he did quite a few movies with Don Siegel. You know, he dedicated Unforgiven to him and Leone. But, but Siegel was kind of had that reputation as well for being a, you know, kind of straightforward director, kind of knew what he wanted, get it, do a couple takes and move on. And I guess he kind of, you know, gleaned that. He liked the way Don made films, obviously, because he kept making movies with him. But you could, he kind of carried that sort of work ethic over into his own films.
Right. Plus Eastwood was in some big movies in the 60s, like Paint Your Wagon and Where Eagles Dare, which were probably very stressful, tiresome shoots.
I would imagine Where Eagles Dare sucked to shoot.
You heard stuff about Paint Your Wagon as well. And
that was a famous disaster, wasn't it? Paint Your Wagon.
Yeah, it was.
Like, and Lee Marvin singing songs.
Yeah. Not the best choices for a musical. Although I've met some blue collar types, that's the only musical they'll watch.
That and like, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas or something.
Yeah, apparently. Eastwood and DeLuise doing numbers, that's all you need. It's strange because it's like, I think he had negative experiences on like bloated shoots or troubled shoots, and he didn't want to, just didn't like doing that. You know, because he viewed it probably as work. And Don Siegel's not one of those directors who like shot incredible scenes that you just remember like a David Lean movie. He was just like, I'm telling you a story and let's shoot this fast and tell a good, tight, compact story.
Well, and I recently watched Riot and Cell Block 11, which is a really tight movie. Like, just it's actually kind of funny because it, like Dirty Harry, it's an issues movie, except it's about the rights of prisoners, you know?
right.
Instead of the Dirty Harry's about the rights of, you know, victims and cops to do their job and all that good stuff.
Well, yeah, because the whole Miranda thing had been a big case a few years before.
Yeah, like, you know, I listened to the commentary with Richard Schiekel on the Blu-ray, and, you know, I didn't really care for his commentary too much.
No, he's not a terribly good critic, and I think I tried listening to it because I got the special edition DVD that's the same thing as the Blu-ray. It didn't intrigue me too much. I never thought much of him as a critic.
No, you know, there would be, like, good bits of information here and there, but he has these boomer tendencies as a critic that I find maddening. Like, he never once mentions John Milius's involvement with the script. And he talks about Harry's gun, the .44 Magnum, which, you know, became an iconic weapon after that. He talks about it as though it was meant to be. He says it seems as though the gun was meant to be absurd, like, you know, like, silly in a way. And I'm like, no, it was meant to be there because it's a fucking big gun.
Yeah. The only thing absurd about the .44 Magnum that Harry carries is that he doesn't use both hands. He shoots with one hand, which is almost impossible.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
At least to do it accurately. And they really goofed on the Deadpool, and this is a problem with Rush Productions, is the killer or the villain in the Deadpool gets a hold of Harry's gun and is also shooting with one hand with the Magnum. And it's like, no, it's like he would struggle with that Magnum because you have to be a very tricked out, experienced shooter to even try to shoot, you know, with the .44 Magnum in one hand. And, you know, it was just laughable. And it's a type of thing where they're just trying to get the shot done and not really paying attention to detail.
Right, and you want the villain to seem threatening, like he could possibly right. hit him. But
and maybe an element of reality with, you know, if he gets a hold of Harry's gun, maybe if he actually couldn't shoot well with it, then you would say, okay, well, this is sort of what would really happen.
Right.
But Deadpool was a comic book. Like, all the sequels are comic books.
Yeah,
anyway.
Deadpool, like, Harry's, like, shooting people with harpoon guns in that movie. You know?
Right.
But I just, like, calling the gun, like, oh, it's kind of taking the pit. It's like, every film critic thinks, like, everything they like has to subvert something. And
yeah.
It's not subverting anything. It's a fucking, no. It's a cigar. It's a gun, you know? It's
the original, the original screenplay was written by some writers who wrote for, like, TV shows like A Gun Will Travel.
Right.
You know, Paladin, Richard Boone. They were TV Western show writers. And I think they wrote, like, Major Dundee. Like, that was the most deep script they'd written. And so Dirty Harry was just kind of, like, updating the Western to modern day, like, hippie world, you know, in post-Miranda.
It
was like, Harry's like that tough sheriff or deputy out of an old Western.
He mentioned, like, in the commentary, he mentioned that Scorpio, the villain, who's a takeoff of Zodiac, which... he also didn't mention.
Schickle really did his research, didn't he?
He goes, serial killers were big at the time, Ted Bundy and all that. And I was like, no, not Ted Bundy. Fucking Zodiac, dude. This is San Francisco. You know?
Oh, that moron. Ted Bundy?
But I know
what a serial killer was.
I was like, this isn't like Silence of the Lambs where he's knocking a chick into his van. It's, you know, it's fucking Zodiac. But
it's more tied to the the Charles Whitman shooting, the Texas Tower. Cause
oh, sure.
Nine.
Yeah,
you know, it's
shooting, picking him off. But he said that him, Scorpio, wearing a peace symbol belt buckle was something mm-hmm. that made people mad at the time, which, you know, I could see. Because it sort of shits on hippie culture. But he said, oh, I don't think it's meant as that. It's meant as, like, you know, it's supposed to be like a... sort of silly, like, oh, he's this killer, but he has a peace belt buckle. I don't think so. There's like a disdain towards hippies in this movie. There's that bit where Clint's, you know, looking at he's staking out that building and he spots that girl in her panties and she's naked and she has those two couples in there having like a little hippie love in and he kind of scowls. Like, filthy.
Yeah,
people.
Yeah. There is a disdain for the hippie stuff,
and you know, like, I wonder if that's a Milius touch. Not to keep bringing it back to Milius, but you know, his movies have a lot of hippie hate in them. Like, you know, the Tulsa Doom cult and Conan is a total like Manson cult. You know,
right. I think that may have been a Milius element. There's also a partial element that. It's implied that Harry might be a voyeur of some type, or
because
he's a little pervy, you know.
There's the bit where he gets his ass kicked by those people for looking in at Hot Mary, that fat chick. And I wasn't quite sure what he was doing there.
yeah, they kind of imply there's a...
And Eastwood's like,
side.
Let him go, you know.
they had him as Prejudice, which could have been part of the pre-Milius screenplay. Like, I would be interested in actually reading the screenplay before Milius got a hold of it.
Yeah, I would be too.
Because I had like, there's stuff in the IMDb, who knows how accurate that is, although it's probably better research than Richard Schickel could ever do. But they said that Harry originally, like, put the gun to his head when he was testing out Albert Popwell in the beginning of the film, and Click, like, with his gun, like, to his head, and that may have been in the Milius script, I'm not sure, but apparently Eastwood and Siegel thought that was too extreme, even for the character.
Right, and it's kind of, I like his, what he does in the movie better, it's kind of a dick thing to do to that guy.
Yeah,
like, you know?
Yeah, he has a sarcastic laugh and everything.
Which,
so.
That scene is fucking great, the bit where, I love listening to Arnold Schwarzenegger talk about that scene, because he gets it wrong. He goes and eats a hot dog, and, you know, there's a bank robbery, and Callahan's, like, in the middle of lunch, and he's just like, ah, shit. And it's just, like, he just goes and ices these fools, and it's just, but he does it like it's nothing. Like, ugh, I guess I gotta go do this. And
right.
It's just, it's so badass, but Arnold's like, he was eating a hamburger while he was, while he was shooting them. It was so crazy. I was like, this guy is the best.
That's pretty much the way Arnold misremembers everything.
Even he said a hamburger. I was like, couldn't somebody have stopped him and said, dude, it was a hot dog. Like, let's go again.
I know that's the whole thing is, like, Harry eats hot dogs. I think that's kind of a carrying thing in every film, too.
Yeah, in the next one, he's always, like, in Magnum Force, he's always like, oh, he'll, like, look at some, like, dead bodies and be like, oh, you want to go get a hamburger, you know, over at the airport. It's the best place. And then there's, like, Palestinian terrorists hijacking the plane.
Oh, yeah, I know. Some of that stuff in Magnum Force just drove me insane.
Magnum Force is pretty goofy movie, but, you know, the first time I saw Magnum Force, I turned it on television, and it was the scene where the cop busts in on that, like, threesome and mm-hmm. shoots them several times, and the girl flies out the window. But I caught that scene on TV, and it was so cut to shit, I had no idea what happened in it. I just all of a sudden saw this chick flying out a window, and I was like, what's
going
on?
That was the first Clint Eastwood movie I saw as a kid, because CBS would run it, like, every other month. Like, Dirty Harry movies were so big on network television in the 70s.
Well, that's what I saw.
They played every other week, it seemed like.
That was the first one I saw, too. I mean, I didn't see the whole thing, but that was my first encounter with a Clint Eastwood movie. It was Magnum Force on TV.
Mm-hmm. Because it aired a lot, and The Enforcer actually aired on two networks, and that was pretty rare back in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Usually a network signed an exclusive deal to one movie, but both NBC and ABC would run The Enforcer.
And that's the one Eastwood directed, right?
Yeah, James Fargo directed it.
Oh, James Fargo.
Right, and Tyne Daly's in that one. That's the third film, and was probably the easiest to censor for television.
I'm thinking of Sudden Impact, I think.
Yeah, you're thinking of the one with Sandra Locke that actually I think was the most successful one.
Well, the second one was directed by Ted Post and assistant director Buddy Van Horn. I kind of wonder how much if Eastwood was like really because Ted Post's other movies look like shit.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and Ted Post wasn't really, like, a scope director.
No.
Like, he directed, like, Good Guys Wear Black and that Burt Lancaster Go Tell Spartans Vietnam movie where it looks like you're in Malibu and pretending it's Vietnam. Even though you get a great Lancaster performance, but you get this, like, flat-looking movie, and it really hurts it.
Well, you know,
and even though it's a good script, that's the problem, and it's, like, this very flat direction, and, you know, Post wasn't really an enthusiastic visual guy.
No, not at all, but... Don Siegel was, because you get this the way Dirty Harry is shot is incredible. It's a very wide lensed movie. You get these wide like shots of San Francisco. You know, there's like lots of big like you know because like a lot of the movies like Scorpio scoping out people from rooftops,
right?
And the police scanning the city and looking out for where the killer might be, and so. I love the look of the movie as a result that Don Siegel gave it.
Yeah, I saw it at the Alamo Drafthouse a few weeks ago, and I was pretty stunned. Like, there's an effect you don't get on television is the way the city is photographed, and it almost really feels like you're on top of the building looking at the city. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very surrounding thing. And the interesting thing is, Don Siegel wasn't really, like, a scope director. He didn't do a lot of films in scope. Even Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I think he shot flat. And he usually shot things in TV format.
Yeah, right. I mean, right in Cell Block 11, it's like, you know, kind of almost an exploitation movie of that time, like ripped from the headlines, you know, it's, you know, square frame, you know, just boom right there, direct. So, but, I mean, he brought a lot of flair to this film. It's really something. I love the way it looks, and I love Clint's outfits.
Yeah. The vest and some of the other stuff is just like in the sunglasses, and he's got the crazy pompadour, which, you know, considering he's like in his early 40s, I think at the time.
Yeah, he was.
but yeah, it's like, and Eastwood did a lot of his own stunts in the film.
Yeah, he did the jump off the bridge onto the bus.
Yeah, that kind of amazed me.
And when you watch it, you see it in the film. You see him drop off. You see Eastwood grimace as he hits the bus. Like, you see him just go, you know.
Yeah. But yeah, it's such a tight film, and it was probably the most imitated cop film of the last 30 years.
And
like
was,
at least until Lethal Weapon, probably.
And it was a really controversial film too. Like Pauline Kael, one of her most famous reviews is her panning of Dirty Harry.
Right, which probably helped the movie's box office because she hated it so much.
Oh, sure. I mean, because it was such a controversial movie. Like, she hated the, you know, that she called it fascist. She also hated seeing, you know, she was from San Francisco. She didn't like seeing San Francisco depicted as this, like, you know, Mega City 1, you know, type of crime hole. It did, you know, because San Francisco, you know, has a reputation for being this, like, lovely liberal utopia. But,
right.
But
it's not, believe me.
But there's a great scene in the middle of the movie where, you know, Scorpio, the killer, has kidnapped this girl, and he's eluded police. And, like, his last encounter with Harry, he beat up Harry, and Harry couldn't really do anything. But he did give him a nice shiv in the leg beforehand. But Harry tracks him down at this, he finds out he's staying at this football stadium, and Harry just tracks him down there. And starts basically torturing him because the guy's sniveling like, "I want my lawyer."
Yeah, he's stuffing on his leg and he's screaming. It's my all-time favorite scene, and my favorite scene in any film of all time.
That shot where he's stomping his leg and the camera just pulls out and you see the fog and such a great bit.
To see that in the theater finally just blew me away.
Oh, I have to. Next time it's showing somewhere, I gotta see it. Cause
that movie has such visual power. Like, you realize nothing is like that nowadays. Nothing even comes close.
Especially in a moment like that, because the villain in this movie is, I mean, you hate this motherfucker.
Yeah, Andrew Robinson did such a great job, I think, with that character. I think he had trouble finding work afterwards.
He teaches acting at USC now, I think.
Oh, interesting. It's like, because I think he said it, like, it hurt his career in some ways because it's like he had
problems.
Well,
I heard he got a lot of shit from people in public, too.
Yeah, oh, I bet he did, because you play a villain like that and everybody just never separates the two.
I mean, but he just has this energy that's insane. Like, when he's on the bus and he's just, like, losing his shit and smacking kids. Mm-hmm. Like, he just has this, it's creepy, but he has this childlike, like, this bratty child quality to him.
Where, right, and it's the hippie generation.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, but, you know, when he snivels for his lawyer and Harry, they find the girl and she's dead. And,
right.
I like the way I said that. She's dead.
She's dead because nowadays he would have rescued the girl in time.
Yeah.
All the things they do in this movie, they wouldn't do today. They'd be too scared to.
There would be the ticking clock and they'd pull her out and you know.
Yeah.
And it would be okay, but she's dead, and what makes it even more frustrating is, you know, the guy gets to walk, and we get the scene where he has to deal with the bureaucracy, where they're like, "Callahan, have you never heard of Miranda rights? This guy..."
Right, and they bring the advisor from the Berkeley School of Law.
Of course it's fucking Berkeley, right?
Yeah, that I remember that really angered Pauline Kael. When it's like, why Berkeley? Why would they bring somebody from Berkeley?
It does. So you're, and, you know, they have the bit where Clint Eastwood goes, "Well, the law's crazy."
Yeah.
But actually, my favorite bit in that scene is he goes, "You think that creep's not going to do anything again?" And the DA or whoever goes, "And what makes you so sure?" And he goes, "Because he likes it."
Yeah, he likes it too much.
Yeah, he likes it too much. Yeah. It's, but that doesn't, that it totally explains, like, that kind of crazy criminal behavior. Like, yeah, he's gonna do it again. He likes it.
Right. Well, I like it is you have a villain that's not sympathetic at all.
No, he's
like,
not.
We seem to have this constant character building, sympathetic villain nonsense that sometimes in movies nowadays, like, they're too scared to have somebody who's just really vile.
I do.
And that you want to root for their death at the end of the movie. Yeah, that's kind of the point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like a villain that I can root for. Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Like, I do like those villains where it's like, the movie's behind this guy, but I'm kind of, you know, like, I'm kind of with Magneto, you know? But
yeah.
not really.
Well, it's like, well, they're all, to me, anytime they do, like, that Magneto character in those silly X-Men movies, it's like, they're just doing Hans from Die Hard.
Pretty much.
Euro trash and, you know, whatever. Oh, he's in the concentration camps. And yeah, but he keeps trying to wipe out the human race, like, in every movie. It's like, why don't you just kill him and save yourself the hassle? It's the problem with leaving the villain alive. And this is my problem with the X-Men movies. Well, one of many problems I have is, like, why is Magneto, like, the villain in every film? It's like if Goldfinger was the villain in 5 James Bond movies.
Was he the villain? He wasn't really the villain in First Class. He kind of becomes the, like, of...
Yeah, yeah, it's like he's really the hero in First Class for, like, half the film.
Yeah, I mean, but, and, you know, he's not... he's kind of... He's, like, a periphery villain in the new one, and...
But The new one I'll never see, and everybody just can't stop talking about how much they're loving it.
It's all right. It's not a bad movie, but it's not like, oh my god, I have to rush out to the theater. I wouldn't have even gone to see it, but I had a friend in town, and he's a big fan of the comics. And
me, that would almost be a reason not to go see the movie.
Well, you know, but we never get to hang out because he's doing his residency for he's a doctor and up in New York, and you know, he doesn't ever get to go out. And so he was like, "Hey, I'm coming into town. You want to go see the new X-Men?" I was like, "Sure," you know.
Yeah,
but well, whatever you want to do, man. Anyway, enough about X-Men. We don't need to talk about that. We're talking about a much better movie.
Yeah, I like movies with a hero in them, unlike the X-Men. So that
that's absolutely.
The X-Men never do anything heroic.
Well, that's why the Wolverine's the best of the X-Men movies.
Because he's a hero for once.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's straight up like a samurai warrior. But but no, I do miss the just completely unsympathetic, sniveling villain that you just like, you know. We all love it when you're in the theater and everybody cheers when the bad guy gets like shot in the head or whatever. When it's just like a really satisfying moment, you know.
Well, everybody gets horrified at thought of that now, but it's like that's what happened in Eastwood and Bronson movies in the 70s, and that's why we still remember them so well today.
I mean, Scorpio's death scene is iconic. Like, you know, the first time we hear that famous speech, "This is the 44 Meg, most powerful handgun in the world. Do you feel lucky, punk?"
Yeah.
You know, the first time it's kind of a funny, like, you know, he's kind of fucking with this guy. And at the end of the movie, he gives the speech to Scorpio, and it's like he is just like furious. You know, it's just like pure like anger and rage. And when he gets to put one in him, it is just, you know, you want to jump out of your seat. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, it's still an amazing moment, and seeing it with an audience at the Alamo, it's funny to see how the audience was still taken aback. Apparently, a lot of people there had not seen it, and they were stunned by what the movie did. Like it's still a strong work today. It's like this is a movie that, you know, action movies today come from a perspective that, don't worry, the government will work out everything,
sure,
or, you know, society will work out everything. This movie, the government's useless.
Yeah.
The church cannot stop Scorpio. You know, nobody can stop him except this somewhat bigoted, mean, you know, cop who's a bit sociopathic or whatever. It's like, but also it's implied he's widowed. You know, his wife was killed.
That's like
they don't tell you why.
No, he says that she was killed. Like, doesn't he say she was killed by I thought he said she was killed by a drunk driver or something.
Yeah, it was a car accident.
Yeah, it wasn't like she was murdered by criminals and he's like,
"She was murdered by criminals and I never got over it.
Yeah,
you know,
now I have to clean up the streets, you know."
Well, now I gotta get revenge.
It's what it does is it tells us that he has no life, basically.
Right.
His life is his work, you know. We never see Dirty Harry's pad until Magnum Force, you know.
Right.
And
he's our only chance.
By the way, you know, there's no romance. There's no female lead in this movie.
No, because it's unnecessary.
Of course. But what I thought was hilarious when I saw Magnum Force was how women are, like, throwing themselves at Harry in that movie.
Right.
This one girl's like, "How come you've never made a pass at me, Harry?" You know? And there's this Asian chick with, like, super long hair who's like, "What's a girl got to do to get into bed with you?" Anytime a girl is that sexually forward with me, I think she's trying to rob me. You know?
Yeah.
I think there's something's up. Like, she's either got AIDS and wants to give it to the world, or she's going to rob me.
It was almost like that. Magnum Force seemed to be made as an answer to critics of Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
Everything in that film was almost like an answer to the critics. Well, no, he's not gay. No, he's not a fascist or whatever. No, he doesn't believe in vigilantes.
It was supposed to be like, oh, well, like, here's the cops that go too far and what happened, you know, like,
because
in Magnum Force, it's a bunch of these, like, these T-1000 traffic cops that are slaughtering people, and Hal Holbrook, the DA's, you know, kind of behind it all, and they're part of like a new world order to, like, because the system's broken, and Harry's like, "Look, I don't like the system, I hate the system, but until something better comes along, I'm sticking with it," you know.
Well, he said something like, "Pretty soon you'll be shooting people for jaywalking."
He goes, "You're gonna shoot someone because their dog pees on your lawn."
But it does have his one of his all-time great lines was like, "Man's got to know his limitations."
Oh yeah, that's a great little bit in the movie.
And after he killed one of the cops at the end of Magnum Force, he said, "He was right. You boys don't have enough experience." Like that actually may be his all-time best line.
Magnum Force, you know, like the first time I saw it, I was like, this movie's kind of cheap, and you know, but I had fun watching it the second time around. And I haven't finished it, but I started listening to the commentary with John Milius, and it's very entertaining.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and he talks a lot. He actually addresses it, talks about, you know, how Dirty Harry was kind of controversial, and this movie's kind of the flip side of the coin because, you know, the first one's about.
Right.
The hunter protecting the tribe. He talks in those, you know, those grandiose Milius terms.
All right, but like it's Wild Bill Hickok.
But it's actually a much more informative and interesting listen than the Sheikl commentary on the first film.
Well, no surprise, Sheikl's commentary sucks.
Yeah, it's not really worth your time. I barely gleaned anything from it that was useful.
Right, and then I think The Enforcer was where it started to feel like a Dirty Harry TV show.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. When you watch The Enforcer...
I don't think I've seen The Enforcer. I don't know.
It's worth watching once. Yeah. You might dig it a lot more than you think. But it's kind of like... It's kind of just routine. Then Sudden Impact, which I think was the most successful out of all of them.
And that's the one where he says, "Do you feel lucky?"
It's not... That one's cartoonish.
Yeah.
And then the Deadpool is a cartoon. Like, yeah, almost like a Dirty Harry TV pilot.
Yeah, it's you know, Jim Carrey singing Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah, and before anybody knew who he was, Guns N' Roses is actually in the film. Mm-hmm. Before anybody knew who they were, yep. Or they were actually getting big as that movie was opening.
Yeah,
they were. That was where they started to rise up. But you know, I never really cared for the sequels that much. It's almost like they're about another cop named Dirty Harry.
Well, I don't think Eastwood cared for them too much either.
Yeah, he just made them as like a studio agreement.
Yeah, it was just kind of like, yeah, I'll get to do, you know, Pink Cadillac or whatever.
right. That first film, though, is just like the original Dirty Harry is such a classic, such a trendsetter. I'm still stunned when I meet people my age who haven't seen it. And I was
that's crazy.
this was like your, I don't know, this is like a trial you went through when you were young, was you watched Dirty Harry. And I don't think people even get it these days. They don't understand why, you know, we like the old stuff so much. But it's like, this is a movie you could not make today.
And, you know, there's so many actors who almost played Dirty Harry instead of Clint, and it would have been so different. Like, at one time McQueen was attached to it, and
Sinatra
almost played the role. Like, he was I think he injured himself or something and he dropped out.
Yeah Paul Newman was another one.
I think Paul Newman didn't like the script.
Thought it was too
right wing for him.
would affect his reputation raising money for cop killers.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Mumia Abu Jamal. Yeah. Well, you always hear, oh, the great Paul Newman. Yeah, he raised money for Mumia Abu Jamal. Like,
but he made salad dressing for free, John.
Right. Yeah, he's just a smart guy I've liked in some films. So come on.
You know, he's good in a lot of movies, but I am kind of intrigued by Adam Carolla's passion for making a documentary about his racing.
Yeah, I don't know if Adam Carolla knows the whole story about Paul Newman.
I don't know either. But I mean, it's just about his race car career. Like, I don't know.
Right,
it's
just racing.
Racing. You know, Adam Newman, you know, a lot of people don't understand. Anybody out there know Tom Cruise? You know?
Yeah, I always thought a lot of actors did that. You know, like,
a lot of them do. Like, you hear Carolla talk about those celebrity Grand Prix, you know, like Adrian Brody's out there driving, you know? Like,
a lot of people's least favorite. Yeah. And the one thing is with Eastwood, all you heard was golf and jogging on the the Pebble Beach every morning. Uh-huh. Where he lived up in Monterey, but he was like jogging on the beach every morning.
In jeans, in blue jeans.
Yeah, strangely he wore a tracksuit, but not like a Philo Beto in those movies where he's jogging in the jeans there.
The one where he hangs out with a monk, with an orangutan, yeah.
Right. but no, that's all you heard about Eastwood was a golfer. Yeah, he was a huge golf fanatic, and I've talked to people who met him at golf courses.
He and Alice Cooper doing holes together.
Right. They say he's a great guy as long as you don't mention the movies to him.
Really?
He doesn't want to talk about movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is understandable. It's like, but he's pretty cool. It's just like a casual dude.
Well, and probably, you know, you probably have a lot of people coming up to you going like, "Hey, he's you know, you don't want to hear." You know, he doesn't want to tell another fucking story about Sergio Leone or whatever.
Right. It's like that's better reserved for the documentaries that he is at least willing to do. He's not like he hides.
Oh,
from
sure.
The camera.
You know, he was in the Milius doc, for fuck's sake. I mean, he'll show
right.
up if he has time.
And actually agreeing with our theory that Milius has not been blacklisted because of his politics.
Yeah.
It's just your movies have to make money. You know?
Yeah.
Just...
he was blacklisted because he just wasn't living up to his. You know, he wasn't putting out profitable material, you know. So.
Yeah, you're not a commercial writer anymore. Yeah. It's like you write art films, basically.
Which is funny. He wrote. Speaking of art films, he wrote Magnum Force with Michael Cimino.
I know. Isn't that's far out.
Who directed Clint in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot with Jeff Bridges? Which
is another great early '70s Eastwood movie that you never hear about. Because Universal owns that film, and they're real spotty with the release of it on home video. I think they put out a limited edition Blu-ray or something, which I don't get that. It's like, why?
Yeah, why?
Like, put it out and let people rediscover it. It's Jeff Bridges is bigger than he's ever been, physically and commercially.
Yeah.
And, you know, Eastwood's always a name. Like, what, do they think that's not going to sell or something? But that's a terrific film.
Yeah, I mean, Clint's one of those names where if he's in a movie, I'll check it out within reason. Like, I don't think I'll ever see Trouble with the Curve or whatever. But
well, if you get a chance, if you haven't seen it, see The Beguiled, that Western he did with Don Siegel before Dirty Harry.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
It's incredible, but it wasn't. I don't think it was popular at the time because it wasn't like Eastwood, the action hero.
Huh. Okay. What do you think of High Plains?
Because you know, High Plains Drifter is decent. I don't like it as much as this. Spaghetti Westerns.
No. That's just such a weird fucking movie.
It's from the guy who wrote Shaft.
Oh, yeah, Ernest Tidyman did write that script.
And a lot of people imply it's actually a plagiarism of Django the Bastard. And I kind of believe that to a certain extent. If you've seen Django the Bastard, it's pretty similar, and that was made a few years before.
Wonder who was in Django the Bastard?
I forget the star of that, but it wasn't like Terrence Hill or Franco Nero. It was another... It was somebody like Anthony Stefan or one of those
like
guys.
It wasn't like Thomas Milian or something.
No. It wasn't Thomas Milian. The thing with Eastwood was I think he did buy the rights to remake The Great Silence, the Sergio Corbucci film.
Well, yeah, didn't that become Joe Kidd?
I think it did because there's certain elements in the film that are straight out of The Great Silence with the Mauser and some other stuff and the kind of idea of a town being taken hostage, but it's almost like they did a complete rewrite and it just didn't resemble the movie anymore. A lot of people don't know this. Eastwood actually optioned Lone Wolf and Cub for a remake in the 70s.
That's funny. I didn't know that.
Which I guess he would have done as a Western, which I often mention that Outlaw Josie Wales, a lot of the action scenes where he's like the super invincible gunfighter, to me almost seemed like that was what you probably would have seen if he'd made a Lone Wolf and Cub as a Western. I'm assuming you would have done it as a Western.
I just love the story behind the guy who wrote Outlaw Josie Wales.
Oh, yeah, the Klansman who claimed he was an Indian.
Yeah, the Native American who, I was a speechwriter for George Wallace, ha ha ha.
Yeah, I was a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan.
Forrest Carter. Asa Earl Carter.
He was Asa Carter, and then he was claiming he was Forrest Earl Carter, and he was some lost Indian tribesman or something.
I wasn't sure which name was before and after.
Yeah, the fake, you'd think the fake Indian was big today with Elizabeth Warren. It was pretty big in the 70s, too, with the fake Indians.
Well, and that's when people were watching Billy Jack and, you know.
Right, everybody wanted to be.
Everybody was all of a sudden, I'm a 16th Cherokee. I must be Native American.
Right, I tell you, the 1/8 16th generation Choctaw, my ancestors cries every time they read that.
Oh, yes. I have, like, 1/16 Cherokee blood, but I always had, like, those friends growing up who did, and then all of a sudden they were, like, really into Native American culture in college or whatever.
Well, I had a coworker who later retired from the government on disability, claiming he fell off of a tank in Iraq, which is funny because he was not part of a tank command. He always claimed he was, like, Sioux. And he would do, like, the sweat lodge and all that stuff. And, I mean, he was the whitest-looking guy you've ever seen in your life. He looked so white, he made Tom Laughlin look Indian.
How dare you, sir. Tom
Laughlin. I mean, he was, like, bald head, white, high-pitched voice. I go up to the sweat lodge. And it's just like, what? You? It's like... And I was trying to envision if he did, like, a Man Call Horse type thing where they, like, stuck the hooks in his chest and pulled him up.
But How dare you denigrate Tom Laughlin? He is a icon of the Native American community.
He's an icon of bad acting.
He's an icon of Hapkido.
Oh yeah. It's too bad I see Bong Soo-Han's face.
Every time I'm about to get in a fight, John, I kick my shoes off, you know?
Right. The whole setup. But the other thing about Dirty Harry they love is the Lalo Schifrin score.
Oh, yes. We can't not mention that jazzy, amazing Lalo Schifrin score.
Oh, it's like Miles Davis fusion era stuff with, like, mixed in with spaghetti Western vocals and things. It's crazy.
You got the drums are just so great. Although, like, Lalo Schifrin did the music for Magnum Force, and it wasn't nearly as...
No.
Exciting. Like, it was just like some like bongos here and there. It wasn't as
it was getting closer to TV.
It didn't have the intensity that it had on the Dirty Harry soundtrack.
Right.
But yeah, that's a great point. That's one of the really noteworthy parts of that film.
Mm-hmm.
So what else? Are we neglecting anything else with this
film? Other than you see Bradford Dillman and who's the other actor who always plays the superiors? You see John Vernon as the mayor.
John Vernon, yeah.
You got a pretty good supporting cast. You got amazing location work in San Francisco. Nothing was shot in Canada, or I don't even think anything was shot in Hollywood. I think it was all shot in location in San Francisco. Maybe some interiors were shot at LA, but it was just like, it's kind of stunning. Even by today's standards, just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I mean, the location work is fantastic. And one of the actors in the movie is Robert Mitchum's brother, who looks like obese Robert Mitchum, basically. he's like one of the big cuts. He's the one who says that Harry hates everybody. Dagos, Mix, you know.
Right. And I think he shows up again in The Enforcer. I think he's one of those characters.
He's in Magnum Force, too.
Yeah. I think he's in some of the follow-up films. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because the Harry movies did so well that there was actually a spinoff paperback series in the early 80s.
Of course.
There was about a dozen Dirty Harry paperbacks, because back then the paperback originals were pretty big, like The Executioner and The Destroyer and reissued Mickey Spillane books. The Destroyer is actually where Remo Williams... Yeah, Mac Bolan, War on the Mafia. The Destroyer was Remo Williams and Chun, which you see in the silly movie, but the paperback series was actually far superior. And the funny thing is, the paperbacks, they were co-created by Warren Murphy, and Warren Murphy wrote the script for The Iger Sanction.
Oh, wow.
The Eastwood film where a climber, I believe, died in the film during the making. It was actually one of the troubled Eastwood
films. That's where he plays a hitman, right? Where he plays like an
assassin. Right, he's like a hitman and a hitman spy who's blackmailed into killing for a secret organization even the CIA doesn't know about. It's okay. It's more like an unintentional comedy these days.
I have it in, I got that Eastwood American Icon with, like, five different movies on it, and it had that Coogan's Bluff, Play Misty for Me, and...
So it's the Universal stuff, because he was making movies for Universal at the time.
It's that one. They put out two different ones. They put out the Westerns, which had, like, Joe Kidd, High Plains Drifter, and one other one I'm forgetting. Two Mules for Sister Sarah, another Don Siegel one.
Right, actually a great film.
And Shirley MacLaine is in that movie, and she said of Clint Eastwood, he's the nicest Republican I've ever worked with.
Yeah. Yeah. As she ignored her daughter and abandoned her in Japan.
Yeah. She's a commie, you know.
Yeah. So she could go get drunk with the Rat Pack. She completely just ignores her kid. Yeah, great going, Mom.
Yeah. She and Warren Beatty are an interesting brother-sister pair. Just
basically two sociopaths, cold-blooded reptiles. Growing up in Hollywood, nobody has anything nice to say about Warren Beatty. They have nothing.
He doesn't
nice
even
to say
do anything anymore. He just like shows up at the Oscars, you know. Like...
He's insignificant. He raised like a tranny with Annette Bening. Like their kid became a tranny.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What does that tell you? You know,
because he hasn't. I don't think he's been in a movie since Bullworth.
No, he hasn't. He shouldn't be in any movie since Bullworth. Yeah. That was a terrible film.
I remember seeing the trailers for that and going, "Are they fucking serious?" Like,
yeah, I went to see it and. Well, the best joke about it, the best joke in the film was actually in the trailer.
I don't remember.
Where he tells the black church, it's like, well, if you'd quit worshiping quarterbacks who slaughter their wives, and, you know. Yeah. And that was the best gag in the trailer. Nothing else in the movie was that funny. Nothing. nothing came close to it. It was just him rapping, and he's badly rapping,
too. I've just never been a Beatty fan. Like, I'm not a fan of Bonnie and Clyde.
I don't get it.
I just, you know, never latched on to his, you know, he's like, you know, whenever you read anything about late 60s, early 70s, you know, you'll read a shitload about Warren Beatty, you know, but...
Yeah, meaningless to me today because a lot of stuff from the 70s doesn't hold up. It's so funny that they'll act like, oh, this Easy Rider, Raging Bull stuff, that was 70s cinema. No, it wasn't. 70s cinema was Jaws, The Towering Inferno, The Sting, The Spy Who Loved Me. Those were the big moneymakers. Star Wars, that was the decade. It wasn't these art films that critics love. Sorry.
Easy Rider's Raging Bulls is a terrible book. Like, yeah, let's face it, it's ridiculous. That's a book guys discover when they're young. And they go, oh my gosh, look at all of these salacious stories about Dennis Hopper, like, staying up all night doing cocaine and editing, like, the last movie. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's all these crazy fucking stories in it, but most of them are, you know, not true. Or it's tabloid journalism. Peter Biskin's
right.
It was
like the big movie of the decade was Smoking the Bandit.
Yeah.
Star Wars and Smoking the Bandit and Jaws and Rocky. Nobody cared about any of these. Scorsese wasn't a name draw at the theater.
No, Scorsese's movies were, you know, he was going to make Last Temptation of Christ, and they took it away from him because King of Comedy bombed so bad. You know, like, Scorsese really, I don't think he became, like, Martin Scorsese until fucking Goodfellas or something. Like, you know, he had the art house acclaim for Taxi Driver and stuff, but he didn't become like a mainstream draw until like Goodfellas probably.
Right. That's true. And I don't even remember Goodfellas doing great. I remember most people catching it on video.
Goodfellas is so fucking good though. I love that movie.
I know. But Danzel Wolves beat it out for the Oscars. So there. Yeah, talk about your fake Indians.
I tried watching Dancing with Wolves and Dances with Wolves, whatever the fuck it's called. I couldn't get through it. It's
people who don't watch Westerns love it.
I was just like, this is just like pompous, like this is just Kevin Costner's ego on a cross, you know? It's just like
right. It's typical like white man saves the day type stuff.
I tell you though, did you see Wolf of Wall Street?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, you should. It's
eventually I will, I just not in a hurry.
It's in that Goodfellas vein of, in terms of entertainment quality.
I mean, I heard it's fantastic. Scorsese signed the free Roman Polanski thing a few years ago. I said, oh, no more Scorsese in the theater. Sorry.
Yeah,
I'm done.
I didn't see it in the theater either. I saw it on video. But
it's like, you don't get my money anymore, punk. So I don't care what a movie
every name on that list, I was just like, really? Like,
Yeah, I guess I can skip your film. Yeah.
It's I think all those people who signed it, there's just a massive disconnect from reality. Spending too much time with your L.A. friends, you know?
Well, I think that's evident when you go see movies. Like, they're just so disconnected.
Well, they don't. Movies today don't really relate to people that well. I mean, I think they relate to people who relate to life through movies, and that's not life, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Or they're making movies for China, basically.
Yeah. I mean, my God, the Red Dawn remake. We get invaded by North Korea. Okay.
Yeah, okay, that's believable.
Like,
it was just it's just cowardly. It's just like just chicken shit, Hollywood, and that's why you won't see anything like Dirty Harry today. They're too chicken shit to make a movie.
No,
like that.
Like, you know, Iron Man 3. Well, the Mandarin's got to be like a Middle Eastern terrorist who's not really a terrorist. He's an actor.
He's actually an actor,
and
he's
a puppet by it's guess what? Guess what? It's the vice president in cahoots with the arms manufacturers.
It's Marvel sucking off that mainland China, that PRC.
I heard that the Chinese audiences thought the scenes added in for them were terrible.
They probably did.
I read a lot of stuff saying it. They thought it was pandering bullshit.
Yeah, they have an eye for this.
Audiences
stuff.
Are smart. They, you know, when it comes
in
to
any
that
country,
stuff,
in any country, they spot that stuff.
I'm not. I say audiences are smart, but sometimes I wonder just the stuff I read on the internet. But you know, that's what.
Well, the people who blab about dumb things on the internet are just people who blab about dumb things. You know, I think audiences in general kind of know how to pick the winners.
Right.
Look at the way Godzilla has done really well at the box office.
That makes me so happy.
Despite all these like pseudo-intellectual, hard hardcore Godzilla fans saying, whitewash is Ishiro Honda's work.
Oh, nobody, what the fuck ever.
Nobody cares. They want to go see a fun monster movie.
And why do you want to spend some more time feeling guilty about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Really, more things have happened since then. Let's update the character. It doesn't have to be this, you know, Japanese guilt trip on us.
Okay? Right. And have you seen Hiroshima and Nagasaki lately? They look better than Detroit.
Great.
They look amazing.
That was one thing I liked about the Wolverine, was that they were like, they actually go to Nagasaki in that movie and they're like, see, good things come out of shitty stuff, you know. They actually like say that.
People like to hear about that over here because they like to blame their failure on generational stuff. But
don't you know the Japanese were going to surrender? They told us, but we bombed them anyway.
Sure.
Yeah, we bombed them anyway. Never mind that that Tojo was having his men training like old men and women and children to fight with sticks, preparing for land invasion.
One thing I've learned in recent years is a lot of people do not read history.
No, they don't. No, they
really don't. They have a cartoon idea of history that comes from watching dumb Michael Moore movies and stuff. They have no clue about history.
They see a documentary that tells you it really was this way, and it's kind of designed to make you feel smart. Oh, I'm in on this.
It's what dumb people do to feel smart instead of reading books and taking classes.
There was this this professor who did a video for Prager University about the myth of the Japanese invasion, Japan was going to surrender, and that dropping the atomic bomb was unnecessary. There's this video this professor did, who's also a Catholic priest, I think. He did he did about it that just totally demolishes that whole argument completely. It falls in line with everything I've read in history books. Now, my history professors would not endorse such an idea because they were too, you know, they were part of this institution that just did not tolerate any thought of that was, you know, that didn't fall into this sort of like leftist revisionism. But
right.
We're way off.
Which
of
is why a lot of colleges are worthless.
Exactly. But
they're very Richard Schickel in their worthlessness.
Oh yeah. They definitely produce film critics like Mr. Schickel. His commentary, it was just so full of like that just boomer nonsense. I couldn't stand it. Like I think he wrote a biography on Clint Eastwood or something.
Yeah, he's been one of the Eastwood has had two critics to kind of did authorized biographies on him, and only one actually wrote the book, and that was Schickel. And the other critic who's good friends with Eastwood was David Kerr, who actually is a really good critic, but David Kerr was fired from a Chicago newspaper for praising The Rookie. And he put The Rookie on his top 10 best of the year, and he was fired for that. And then I think Eastwood called up the editor and got Kerr his job back.
That's ridiculous, though. It's like, oh, you liked it. Like, you know, was this The Rookie with Dennis Quaid?
No, Charlie Sheen.
Okay, I don't think I know that one.
It was Eastwood and Charlie Sheen, and the villains were Sonia Braga and what's his name? The dead guy who played Gomez in the Addams Family.
Oh, Raul Julia. Yeah,
they played Germans. But no, it's like David Kerr actually praised the film and put it on his top 10 of the year. He didn't like Do the Right Thing. Like, he's one of the only mainstream critics who actually dismissed Do the Right Thing.
Oh, that's racism, bro. Just like it's racism, and he said that Soderbergh beat Spike Lee at Cannes that year. It's racism.
And he also had a negative review of Boys in the Hood that I thought was dead on.
Really? I haven't seen Boys in the Hood. Shocking. I've never seen
it. You don't have to. It's going to come off pretty silly today. Everybody thought it was, like, this important film. And Dave Kerr basically sliced it up as, like, well, it's misogynistic and... You know, it's pretty stupid, and he pointed it all out in his review, and it actually got printed. It was reprinted in a book of negative reviews of popular, well-loved movies.
Oh, and a lot of those books that do that are doing that to say, hey, look at how stupid critics are.
You know? Right, but it's like, but John Simon's review of Star Wars held up. I thought Pauline Kael's review of Clockwork Orange held up. I thought that Dave Kerr's review of Boys in the Hood made sense. Oh, and I think it had Pauline Kael's review of Thelma and Louise, which is hilarious.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the legendary ones.
Where she said Louise deserved to be raped in the parking lot.
Paul, Pauly Kael like has had a history of doing that, like of saying like, oh, this woman deserved what she got in this movie.
Yeah, she's a mean bitch.
Like the Village Voice hated her because she would say stuff like that. Like they would.
Oh, I know.
Like they would always print anti Pauline Kael pieces.
Yeah, she really angered people, but it was pretty hilarious. But strangely, I think it was before Armand White became a big thing because I can't remember if he had anything.
Pauline Kael was a fan of Armand White.
He is a good writer.
Quote for one of his books.
Mm-hmm. I know he's a good writer because if you ever link to his stuff on Facebook, you get a lot of angry comments.
Oh, you get a lot of pissed off people.
Look who wrote a Look at Me review.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Armand White's one of the few critics I care to read. So.
Yeah, it's like, at least I'm thinking when I read the review.
I like a guy who makes me think about a movie, like, a different way.
Exactly.
You know, from a different perspective.
Yeah.
And I like that he's gay and black, but has these, like, right-wing, like, things.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it makes him more interesting as a critic.
Yeah.
It's just like, you're getting an interesting point of view.
But I always hate that, though, when critics, like, pan something popular and they get, like, they lose their jobs. Or they're like, how dare they? They don't love this this movie that, of course, you're supposed, like, Armand White didn't like Toy Story 3. How dare he? Like, I saw Toy Story 3 once, and I thought it was all right. You know, and guess what? I'll never watch again. Toy Story 3. So there you go.
I remember watching. I was like, "What's really well done, but why is it so heavy-handed for a kids' movie?"
It's like Schindler's List for kids. You know, like
It's like I wasn't a big fan of it, but it was Tom Sharpling's the best show, and he talked about Up was like the most depressing thing he'd ever seen.
The first 10 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, he was like, what is this, for hard kids?
It's like Ingmar Bergman scene, like, for children.
Yeah, I was like, geez, what's the use of life? It's just miserable. Why is it mandatory to like all this stuff? I don't get it.
I don't understand.
It's like the hatred. Yeah?
Like, Bret Easton Ellis talks about this a lot, how, like, if you don't like something, well, oh, you're a hater, you're like this... You're a jerk. Like, you're just being mean and negative. It's like, no, can't people just have an opinion that's different on something? Like, they don't like it. You know?
Popmatocracy. We love to praise the mediocre stuff.
I mean, I just see, like, so much, like with this new X-Men movie. Like, a lot of people are saying, oh my gosh, this is, like, the best X-Men movie yet. It's, you know, such a great movie. I'm like, this franchise is such a fucking train wreck. You know? Like,
yeah.
Like, there are so many plot holes and inconsistencies from movie to movie, it makes your head spin. And it's, even with this movie kind of tries to correct that in a certain way, but it's still there. Like, this franchise is still a freaking train wreck. Like, X-Men The Last Stand, like, that and that Wolverine move, that first Wolverine movie really put a monkey wrench in all their continuity, and it's just, you know, a complete mess. And I don't understand how you can watch this movie and just go, whoa, this brilliant, man, you know, like,
they just love the idea of an X-Men movie. It has nothing to do with it was a good movie.
Well, it's like, remember the first movie, like, you know, which kind of helped start this whole superhero craze with movies, the first X-Men movie. You know, it's not a particularly good film. We've talked about this many times. It's fine if you were to put it as a TV pilot, you know?
Yeah.
But as a TV pilot, it functions just fine. But as a movie, there's a lot of exposition-y dialogue. It's kind of cold to look at. It's not a visual.
It's all set up. Everything's a setup. Everything is a setup for something else.
Exactly. And it's just, it's not a particularly good movie, but a lot of people loved it because, oh my god, we got a live-action X-Men movie. You know, like, it just kind of got...
Well, the idea is it's better to have an X-Men movie than none at all, and let's overpraise it.
Well, it's like it got
these movies have nothing...
Well, it got praise for being an X-Men movie that wasn't a complete pile of shit, you know?
Yeah. It's like, what are you praising? Why should anybody want to see this who's never picked up those silly comic books?
No, yeah, your function, like, because there's so many little things, like, you know, you watch those X-Men movies, there's all these characters that pop up, and the only way you could possibly give a shit is if you know who they are to begin with. Like,
all I know is everybody was telling me X-Men 2 is one of the best films I'd ever seen. And I went to see it, and I'm like, okay, basically all they do is kill army guys doing their job, and they run away from water.
Well, that's like, the thing. Is like, when I watched X-Men 2, I became very aware of how what writer tools the mutant powers were. Like, there's a mutant for every little situation to get out of. But where it became really obvious was when, like, and you've brought this up, that this giant mass of water's coming towards them, and Jean Grey has to kill herself to save them. Whereas they've got fucking Iceman right there on the plane.
Freeze the shit.
He can
it's
just
called
walk
water.
Out
he freezes it.
We've seen him make a wall of ice before. Why can't he do that? And, you know, they didn't bother. All you had to do was write something where he gets knocked out or something, you know, where he gets incapacitated, and you could have made.
But they had to have the mandatory dead Jean Grey. They had to have the dying Jean Grey.
They wanted to
but
get
in
to
the comic books, I think she died in combat.
Yeah, they wanted to get to the Dark Phoenix saga, which they bungled terribly. X-Men The Last Stand, she just stands around the whole time until the end. She decides to start destroying shit, and Wolverine just kills her, and that's it.
Because they don't know how to make these things. They have no clue what they're doing. They don't have a clue. Oh, they make money. Do you watch them 10 years later? Do you really watch them? Do you go out and buy a Blu-ray of the first two films and rewatch them? Do you really have a good time watching? I'd love to know. You know, do you really enjoy it? And it's garbage. You show your kids this stuff and say this is good. I'd rather watch an old Ultraman episode. Ultraman's a hero. He actually saves the world. Every episode. I don't know what the hell these X-Men do except whine about acceptance and understanding. Well, I can go to any junior high, become a guidance counselor, and hear that stuff every week.
Well, that's why the Wolverine's the best one, because it has none of that bullshit. It's just
And I only mentioned the director's cut, because that's the only one I've
that's
seen.
That's the only one I've seen too. Because that one's quite good. I mean, I watched it again the other day, because I saw that new one, and I went, I'm going to go watch The Wolverine again, watch a better movie, you know?
it's a really good movie. I was surprised.
Yeah.
But different director, different idea, you know, some filming in Japan. They had Hiroyuki Sanada, who I remember from all the old Toei films with Sonny Chiba and Etsuko Shiomi. Like, they hired all the right
talent. Right, they did. Yeah, because that guy's got a great resume, Hiroyuki Sanada.
One of the best.
The first horror movie I fell in love with was Ringu.
Oh, okay. But you know, everybody wants to go see this new one because Mystique cries or some shit. I don't know.
Jennifer Lawrence was really bad in this one. Like, and it wasn't like, she's not a bad actress. It's just, she's just, don't get out of my way. I must kill, you know? Like, it's just.
It's a contract obligation. She's under contract to do that
and
film.
She gets a nice check from it too, you know?
Yeah, she didn't do it because she wanted to. She was on a contract. She had to do it. That's like I heard Ed Norton was paid nothing for The Italian Job. Like he was paid scale because he's under contract and he had to do the film.
Wow.
Like he was paid nothing for it. It was just like, you're under contract, buddy. You got to make this movie.
The Italian Job. There's a movie that's aged well, too. I remember watching it with my dad, and I went to see it. My dad just was like, these guys are doing an underwater heist in Venice. You can't see shit in the water in Venice. It is so black and disgusting. There's like, if you submerged yourself in that water, you would get like every disease known to man.
they were in the TV show Wonder Woman world, where every time you go underwater, it's like crystal clear.
I was just like, my dad just couldn't get over that from the beginning. Understandably, because he spent a lot of time over there. He's just like, no.
Yeah, it's an idealized fantasy version of Europe. It's not what Europe really is.
I mean, Venice smells. He also says Venice smells like a bag of dicks, too.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it at all.
Unlike sunny San Francisco. I love the little gay references here and there in the Dirty Harry movies. In Magnum Force, he has like the gay neighbor upstairs. Hey, what are you doing with that mailbox? What are you doing? Hey, that's my mailbox too, mister. Don't you get smart with me.
It's on those ruthless 70s kind of stereotype things where they could portray that stuff for laughs. Can't do it today.
No, you can't get away with kind of like having the comic relief, like lighten the toes, a Fett guy, you know?
Right.
or they would do the thing where they would like imply that the villain is gay.
Well, even in this where he's like, where Scorpio's like, all right, now hand over the gun. Ooh, my, that's a big one. And apparently Andy Robinson improvises that line. And according to IMDb, the crew cracked up and it probably did happen, but they had to cut the take because everybody's laughing so hard.
I had heard, I don't know what you've heard about this, that the end where he shot Scorpio, saved the day, whatever, he pulls out his badge and he looks at it and he kind of tosses it. It's like the end of High Noon a little bit.
Yeah.
I had heard that in the script he was supposed to kind of look at it and examine it and then put it back in, like kind of put it back and walk away. But Clint changed his mind at the end, at the 11th hour, that he wanted to toss it or something.
It's a better ending.
Yeah.
The sequels kind of make it all seem dumb, but...
Well, and it kind of brings it back to, that Western influence a little bit, the
show. Right, because it's a Western. In fact, I think the best, one of the best Elmore Leonard novels was kind of a ripoff of this movie, and that was High Noon in Detroit, City Primeval, which I thought was fantastic. And none of his other books are ever that good, because he kind of hit some sort of... height with that book. It was in the mid-70s set in Detroit, and it was very similar. Basically a Western in modern day, a modern city.
Modern day.
And maybe spun off from the fact that Leonard was kind of a screenwriter who was getting his stuff looked at by Eastwood before it was, went to anybody else. Mr. Majestic was written for Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I was about to say Mr. Majestic. All he wanted to do was
Yeah, Elmore Leonard never got over the fact that Bronson played Mr. Majestic, because it's not who he wrote it for. He didn't like Bronson in the film. And yet it's one of the iconic Bronson roles.
Yeah. A lot of people like that movie, Mr. Majestic.
It's pretty decent. It's fun. I mean, a lot of the Bronson stuff is just fun from that era. Mm. It's not great. He never made anything like a Dirty Harry, but probably the closest he did was Violent City, is one of his Italian films.
Well, and I love Once Upon a Time in the West. I know it's not a cop movie, but
Yeah, well, it's not really a Bronson movie.
No,
everybody,
it's not
more of Henry Fonda
Bronson film at all.
No, not at all. I love the movie, but it's not a Bronson movie.
He doesn't have his mustache in it either. Ugh.
Yeah,
the drummer for Saint Vitus yesterday had a Charles Bronson T-shirt on.
Now that is cool.
Yeah, I went up to him. I said, "Dude, I want that shirt. It's fucking awesome."
Sadly, nobody was wearing that at the Stone Cold screening I went to yesterday at the Alamo Draft.
That's a shame. You'd think there would be, though. There's always, those hipster weirdos that go to Alamo Draft House screenings.
Not here anymore. I don't know if there ever was in the southern Denver suburban area.
Huh, okay.
Yeah, we just don't seem to have that type of movie cult. I don't, a lot of times these screenings are sparsely attended.
Is that because people get shot up there at screenings, though?
That happened in Aurora, which to me feels like that's two cities over.
Yeah, but it's all the same to me, down here.
Yeah, you look on a map, it's all the same. But no, it's the southern... It's nobody goes to these, archive movie screenings. I got the last remaining print of 35mm of Stone Cold. Nobody went... Six people there.
It's funny, at the Draft House, it's kind of hit or miss. The screenings either sell out or... you kind of have the pick of the litter there.
Right. Here, if it's Godzilla versus Smog Monster, it's almost sold out. Those are, if it's Enter the Dragon, that almost sell out. Bruce Lee still sells the seats. But the Dirty Harry was half filled. It did decently. But if it's something independent or a little more obscure, forget it.
Yeah.
Nobody's there.
That's the way it is here. And at the Texas Theater, it's the same way. It just kind of depends on what's showing.
Yeah.
Goblin played there recently and I didn't get to go. I was pissed.
Oh, yeah. Goblin show I went to here was pretty good.
That's right.
Not great, but it was pretty good. It's not a group you think you'd ever see live anywhere.
No, I think that was the first time they ever played Dallas. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they never toured America.
I heard that at Phil Anselmo's horror festival thing, he was playing live to Suspiria. Claudio Simonetti was playing live to Suspiria or something. I don't know.
How awesome.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. It's all right.
They should have had Lalo Schifrin play live to Dirty Harry.
Oh, I know. Just have a drummer, the dude in Bronx Warriors on the...
Yeah!
just doing jazz drumming to over Dirty Harry.
Greatest scene ever.
Oh, That's what this movie was missing, was just like cutting to a drummer on the street. Like,
well, it's like if you look at the influence this movie had on so many films in the 70s and 80s, it's insane. Like every good cop having a bad day, like a poster, that automatically a dead giveaway that movie was ripping off Dirty Harry.
Was it and that gun, the 44 Magnum, became like John Milius said on the Magnum Force commentary before Dirty Harry, nobody cared about that gun afterwards. He said the price went from like $137 to $500. And there was a wait list at every gun shop for it. And he said that for the Magnum Force production, they had to scour to get they had to go to like an obscure police surplus shop to get their 44 Magnums.
Jeez.
They were they were so backed up, you know.
It's true. And it's like the Italian crime genre of the 70s, super influenced by Dirty Harry. Every Maurizio Merli film has a scene where he's like gives up when they let out some killers, you know, early, and he's like, well, the law is crazy, you know. It's like they all have that scene. It's in so many films, but Dirty Harry inspired so much. It's like any like badass cop going after the bad guys and breaking the rules.
Was like a takeoff on Harry a little bit, you know.
It was. There was I think the idea, they thought that Star Wars was going to be a big deal, or already was, and Judge Dredd was based on Dirty Harry. Like, let's take this to the extreme. If you had Dirty Harry in the future,
well, there you go.
He's totally intent. Yeah, I read an interview with the creators, like John Wagner and the other guy, and they said, yeah, he was meant to be Dirty Harry in the future, like just taken to the extreme,
which is of course why the movie Dredd rocks so hard, because it's so dirty.
Exactly. It's the closest thing to a Dirty Harry movie since the original.
Exactly. Like, you have the loathsome villain, you know, and the cop who just like, except in this movie the law is on his side, he is the law. You know, there's no bureaucracy at all.
So his problem is corruption. Like, judges have been bribed, so
right. That's a small price to betray the law.
Spoiler warning, I guess we do Dredd as a future show if it wasn't so over discussed already. And
oh yeah,
it's
cult has grown so fast, it's insane.
Yeah, which I kind of saw happening when I was one of maybe three people attending a Sunday night screening.
I could see
a cult building.
I was one of a few people in there when I saw it, but everybody loved it. And when we got out of the theater, we were all talking about it. They were all clearly people who were fans of the comic, and that's why they went to see it. Because everybody I talked to, I said, dude, you got to see Dredd. They said, I don't want to see a remake of that shitty Stallone movie, you know?
Right. But the people who knew the comic, they were like, oh my god, like, but I've talked to people who've watched it like four or five times on video.
Oh, I've watched it at least four times, maybe, including the theater, probably five.
Saw it once, still haven't watched my Blu-ray that I ordered about a year ago.
It holds up, man. I mean, it's way fun. I love
it. I'm sure it does. Just sitting down and watch it. You know, I got like stacks of Shaw Brothers films to watch. So,
of course,
if anybody knows me, it's old westerns and Shaw Brothers movies by the truckloads.
Yeah, John's posting about them on Facebook every day.
And basically just baffling everybody.
Well, anyways, I think that's about it for this week. Anything else you want to add before we finish it up?
I've been checking out a podcast called The Cromcast, which is these guys who are fans of Robert E. Howard, and they're basically discussing Robert E. Howard's writings in detail. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no jokes, there's no celebrity impressions, there's none of the stuff you usually get, no cult of personality you get from a lot of podcasts. These guys are just really talking about Robert E. Howard's writings, and an episode I listened to, they were talking about the comic books in the 70s based on the, you know, the Howard stories like Conan. Like Savage Sword of Conan, there was a whole discussion about that and the artwork and stuff done. And I mean, for somebody who really digs this stuff and can appreciate a podcast that's about something esoteric or very, you know, very specific to its subject or exclusive to its subject, I think it's a brilliant podcast. And I'm checking out more of it.
Yeah, I saw you plug it, and I listened to their episode on Red Nails, and I really enjoyed it. So definitely.
I haven't even heard that yet. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's a good show. So yeah, quick plug out to our friends at Cromcast. Go check them out, especially if you like weird fiction, Robert E. Howard, like any of the Weird Tales writers. But yeah, Dirty Harry, it's out on Blu-ray. I got it on a twofer with Magnum Force. Check out Magnum Force 2 and listen to that John Milius commentary, because it's well worth checking out.
Oh yeah, definitely. I say check out any of the Dirty Harry sequels, but watch the original.
I think
first.
The sequels are fun. You know, they're just not like going to blow your mind like this first movie. They're just Dirty Harry sequels are kind of like they're fine for like a Sunday afternoon. You know, you don't want to think too hard about
yeah.
it. You know?
and that's what your local television would show if they didn't have a sporting event that got rained out or something.
Truth.
They would run Magnum Force or the Enforcer.
You have Magnum Force, the really confusing threesome shootout. Cut for TV, you know?
Right. A lot of stuff was cut.
Yeah. Well, anyways, well, that does it for this week. Stu will be back next week, and we will be starting a fun series for the month of June. So we're looking forward to that, and check in next week to see what that's all about. Well, that's about it. So adios.
Yeah, mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.